is Digital Marketer. Today, it's Daniel Harmon.
We've got a really, really exciting guest today, none other than Chief Creative Officer of Harmon Brothers, Mr. Daniel Harmon. So Daniel Harmon is the creative mind, well, one of the creative minds behind all of the viral ads that we've seen, Poopery, Squatty Potty, Chapbooks, Purple Mattress, and more. And his videos have been viewed more than, I actually had in my notes, 1.2 billion, but since then it's actually been risen to 1.3 billion. So a lot of views there. But he's going to share with us a deeper look into his creative process, kind of give a behind-the-scenes look of what they do at Harmon Brothers. So without further ado, Mr. Daniel Harmon. All right, let's just jump right into it. Awesome. So today I really want to focus on the creative process and developing content that sells. Okay. You're obviously very good at that. We've seen your credentials.
Well, thank you.
But first, before we go into the nitty-gritty, I want to learn a little bit about more of where you came from. What was the beginning of your journey? Where did you come from? And how did you get to where you are today?
Awesome. I was born in Idaho. And I know that sounds inconsequential, but it's not. I come from a family of 9 kids. And ultimately, I was raised on a potato farm.
Okay.
And how that ties in is we were very poor. And so we were always thinking of different little businesses to make money with. And one of them was a potato sales business where we would get fresh Idaho potatoes from my uncle's farm.
Okay.
And we would throw them in the back of a pickup truck in these 50-pound boxes and transport them, I'm sure illegally, down to Utah where there are some big families.
Yep.
And where not all of their neighbors were potato farmers like mine were. And we would sell them door to door. And ultimately, the pitch was basically like, knock, knock, hi, I've just brought a load of fresh Idaho potatoes down from my uncle's farm in Idaho, and I'm earning money for college or to pay for my mission for my church, and do you eat potatoes? And they would either say yes or no, and then if they said yes, great. If not, I just kind of turn my tail between my legs and walk away.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know anything about overcoming objections or anything like that. But what we realized is in taking several of those loads of potatoes down, it was my brother and myself and my cousin got involved, was that we could make more money than like minimum wage jobs. And especially when you're mooching off of your uncle's truck
right.
and he's not charging you miles and that kind of stuff. And eventually we got successful enough with this enterprise that he went to an auction, our uncle did, and bought a 15-passenger Ford van, $900 at auction. He bought it and it was from this copper mine in Utah. And he said, I bought this at auction and you're buying it from me. And we were like, okay. Yeah. It was $900. The first car we ever owned was a 15-passenger Ford,
wow.
Ford van when we were teenagers. And
amazing.
We would load that thing up and drive the wheels. We didn't, you know, we weren't into maintenance because it was just any expenditure mm-hmm. was too much. And so we drove the thing until it blew tires on the freeway. So not the safest thing in the world. But yeah, that was my first kind of jump into sales.
Yeah.
And then later on, to kind of pay my way a little bit more through college, I did a summer sales program selling ADT alarm systems door to door. And then I learned a little bit more about the structure of selling.
Right.
About grabbing someone's attention right off the bat. We learned about being able to overcome objections, being able to relate with people.
Yeah.
And we're very successful at that. And so, in all honesty, we learned to sell face-to-face with people long before we applied it to online video and social media.
Right, right. So that yeah. all came together to apply straight to what you're doing now with Harmon Brothers.
Yeah, eventually, kind of in a roundabout way, but yes, different
cool.
different sales jobs, yeah.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, you've obviously got a lot of creative things going on in your brain. I want to learn a little bit more about some of your creative inspirations.
Okay.
What kind of led you? What books did you read? What people did you follow?
Yeah.
What inspirations did you have to kind of lead you to develop your unique storytelling strategy?
Yeah, so I've always been a big fan of Pixar.
Okay.
And so very much followed the stuff that John Lasseter was doing. And I know he's been pulled into all that stuff. Not talking about his personal life, just talking about
yeah.
him creatively. He's obviously a genius. And so much of Disney and Pixar was an influence. And then I went through the creative advertising track at BYU, where they taught about how to come up with really great concepts and taught me a lot of like design skills and branding skills that I've gone on and applied. And so I actually, books that I felt like were really instrumental in shaping my creative thinking, how to get ideas. is a really good one. It's a short read, which is really fun, but a lot of really practical stuff of different things that people do to get ideas going. Another one is Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, which is kind of a classic advertising text. Draw some principles from there as well.
Yeah. Heard you mention StoryBrand upstairs.
Yes, StoryBrand has become one more recently for our company. It's funny, StoryBrand, we were doing that stuff with videos, like we were kind of following that pattern of having a character that runs into a problem and has this guide and everything. We were doing all that before, then we read StoryBrand, and we were like, oh, that's why we do that. But like it was after the fact, you're like, wow, that kind of puts into context a lot of the things that we've, I guess, been getting right kind of instinctually.
Yeah.
But again, having applied that from sales prior. So Building a StoryBrand by Donner Miller is really good. Creativity Inc. by Ed Catmull, who's the president of Pixar. I'm a big fan of that one. Some other ones that I like are The User Method.
Okay.
Forget who the author was, but The User Method is actually talking about things from an entrepreneurial perspective of innovating, that you start first by solving a problem for yourself. Like, for example, Mark Zuckerberg was solving a problem for himself in creating Facebook. Like, he wanted to be able to network with people in that way. And then when you do that, you're actually representative of a larger demographic that's out there. And when you solve that, then it makes sense for them. And then from there, you can continue to get feedback and innovate on that. And I feel like that's my starting point with all creativity, is I always ask myself, what sells me? And if this message is selling me, okay, that's my starting point. And then from there, you get feedback from other people to kind of gut check. Is this message on? Is that? But it's I feel like the starting point is always kind of satisfying yourself as a customer, as a viewer, and as a consumer.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. That's great. So a lot of the ads that you've produced utilize humor. And it's a big component, but would you say that humor is essential for the success of these advertisements, or is it just another piece of the puzzle?
No, just another piece of the puzzle. Benton in the presentation today talked a lot about rhythm.
Yeah.
Humor is a really good tool for rhythm because you can present some information and you can deliver a joke.
Right.
And you can give some information and you can deliver a joke. And it has a nice rhythmic pacing feel. It's almost like a nice top 40 song, kind of a feel to it. But it's only one of the many tools. The main things that you want to tap into, I feel like, are you want your content to be very relevant and relatable and that it connects emotionally for the person. Right. And humor is just one emotion, right? It's just triggering laughter. It's just one of the many emotions. It's a great one. Mm-hmm. But we have one of our videos that we did for a nonprofit group. And I'm not going to get political here, but it's a nonprofit group that provides medical mobile buses for women in crisis pregnancies.
Okay.
And specifically, it gives them free ultrasounds, free pregnancy tests. And then when they see the free ultrasound and if they decide to keep their baby, it gives them resources for adoption or for financial support and aid, different things for women in crisis pregnancies. And so we really like what they're doing. It's this organization called Save the Storks. But when we tried to approach the subject of abortion, which is a really loaded topic, it didn't feel like you could do that from humor. We tried, and it just felt like it was falling flat. And so we went for just connecting emotionally in a really relatable way with people. And it was very effective. It's a 12-minute long video. It's a mini documentary. Mm-hmm. But they were able to, they had a goal for how many monthly partners, the people that donate to the monthly, they wanted to have by the end of the year of the campaign.
Yeah.
And they achieved it within 3 months.
Wow.
And it's got, the campaign I think has over 7 or 8 million views on it across it. And it was just a very powerful tool. But again, it was a dramatic piece.
Yeah.
You know, it was a mini documentary. It was very unlike any style that we've done. But a lot of filmmakers say that like humor and drama come from a similar place. And so we've kind of come to subscribe to that.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So you said 7-8 million views.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, that's in the realm of virality as we know it. Should achieving virality really be a goal? I mean, a lot of the videos that you've produced are mega viral.
Yeah.
But is that a part of this process? Is that what you're going for? Or is that just kind of a positive, end result?
I'd say a positive end result.
Okay.
And to give some context on that, we've actually never really set out from the get-go to make a viral video for any of our clients.
Okay.
In fact, we usually tell them, make it good enough that it doesn't have to be viral. Because then if you can spend a dollar behind it and you can get like $2 back in revenue or $1.50 or whatever the metric you need to have is, then you've got like a flywheel built up. It's like a machine. And a lot of people, a lot of marketers are trained to think in terms of like quarterly budgets. This is how much I'm going to spend. That's fine. That can be a really good starting point. But what we say is if you've got like $100,000 set aside for a quarter to spend on marketing, well, if you spend $100,000 and it brings that much more back, why not continue to spend on that? Why does it need to be limited to that? If you know that you're spending money and you're getting more back, that's great. And then the shares and the views and all that stuff can come. So we have had some viral hits. It's increasingly hard to do that. And again, I feel like it's catching lightning in a bottle.
Yep.
Super hard to do, unpredictable, equally shocking when you do it. So why not focus on what you can control, which is the conversion and the branding and all that stuff. And hopefully you make it great enough that it's shareable, which obviously helps you in the algorithms and things like that.
Yeah.
But if you start out for virality first, I feel like you're often setting yourself up for failure. And so much of what we view out there as viral usually isn't viral, right? So much of what you see on Facebook Watch now has 10 million followers behind it. And it also has a whole bunch of content leading up to that that has come to expect content from this person. And so, yes, it's getting shared all over the place. It's got a huge platform to jump off of. Or a lot of the marketing videos that you see or advertising that breaks out and we label as viral, it's got huge PR plays behind it, influencers and stuff that are plugging in. And that's all smart stuff.
Yeah.
You want to do all those things. But if you're just, here, let's upload and hold our breath, like you are signing yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
And no so I would say definitely you want to control what you can control. And virality is unfortunately not one of those things. And especially with Facebook's algorithms now, they treat advertisers very differently than what they treat people that are just creating the original content.
No doubt. Yeah, it was really interesting. Little side story here. Mm-hmm. So a couple of years ago, back before all these big changes on Facebook and YouTube and the algorithm shifts, a couple of friends of mine set out to make a viral video.
Yeah.
And that was our starting goal. So we sat in a room, brainstormed, and said, what can we do? And we landed on the idea that some guy was going to go into In-N-Out Burger and just eat $50 worth of In-N-Out, like an absolute maniac.
Hey, yeah.
Produce the video.
I'm hungry right now.
Yeah,
so this is killing me.
I mean, you know, of course, double. Yeah. Shot the video, added a stock sound in the background of fast food environment, put it up, and within 2 days, we'd gotten over 2 million views.
Nice.
But
guys cracked the code.
YouTube and Facebook saw that as, I don't remember the exact terminology, but they said, this is not, you know, along our guidelines. They basically said you faked the system, and so they deleted the video.
Oh, wow.
But it's just really interesting to see. I mean, I know you're talking about how nowadays it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, we tried it once again over the next couple of years, and it just never worked.
Could
like
never
it did the first
replicate
time.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you get that initial spike.
Yeah.
But then it's like a flash in the pan, and the sustainability long term is not great.
Exactly.
And so a much better strategy we feel like is to plan to spend into it with marketing, to plan to test into what works best.
Yep. Do you find that a lot of the videos that have gone massively viral still continue to drive massive sales for the brands that have partnered with you?
Yeah, they do continue to drive sales. For sure, the algorithms seem to all favor the most recent stuff.
Yep.
And so once that trails off, if the video is still good and it still converts, you're just fine. Mm-hmm. But the long term, the long tail, like, so for example, if we were to take Squatty Potty, I think across all video variations, that one has over 300 million views.
Yeah.
Our best estimate is that had we never put an ad dollar behind it, just left to its own on virality, it probably wouldn't have crossed over 20 or 25 million views total. And that's where it would have stayed and maybe just had a few thousand views per day after that. And that's just the nature of it.
Wow.
So you want to have something that's much more sustainable and predictable where you're buying the eyeballs to come, and then you know how many of those are turning into customers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So with the massive success of these videos, I'm sure you've got a lot of different companies coming and approaching you and saying, hey, can you make one of these for me? What do you look for in a company before you say yes to creating a piece of content for them?
It's a great question. So we usually, our starting question is always, are we passionate about the product or the service that's coming to us?
Yeah.
And I always say, nothing sells better than the truth. And when you are speaking from a place of passion, something that you believe in, then it's easy for you to sell. And I noticed that when I sold potatoes, something I had grown up eating my whole life.
Yeah.
And so I was very familiar with selling that. It's a product I believed in. It was fresh and all those things. Same thing with ADT alarm systems. I knew when I was selling it, I was like, okay, this is something I'll have in my house someday, that kind of stuff. That's always our starting point. And the other reason behind that is kind of going back to that user method principle is when you are sold on a product yourself, then it gives you very unique insights because you can think like a customer. So you can go through the process of when you were first introduced to that product and say, man, what was it that sold me at the beginning? What was like the tipping point for me to where right. I was like, oh, I've got to have that thing. Or yes, this is awesome.
That aha moment.
That aha moment is what you're going for.
Yep.
And so then you don't even have to like go into customer data and all that stuff. You kind of know it instinctively. And those things kind of become backup to it.
Yeah.
But that's always kind of the starting point, again, is what sold me. And we feel like we've just got to be able to speak from a place of truth on behalf of our clients.
Definitely.
And so that's where we always start. And so admittedly, we probably have 1 out of every 100 people that approach us.
Wow.
That we find like fall into that perfect fit. Now, granted, a lot of them are just not in the range of having a big budget, or they're not at that stage in their company, that type mm-hmm. of thing. A lot of those, you know, it might be more than half of them that are in that.
Yeah.
But then we have so many others, they're like, hey, I want you to sell this whatever no-name thing that isn't different in any way from anything else or whatever. And we're just like, that's not really exciting to us. We'd prefer to reserve our opportunities and our limited resources to something that we're really gung-ho on.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. So now that you've decided on the clients that you're going to work with, what does that process look like? How do you start to sit down with them and work through that, you know, creative development? Or is it all done with, you know, you and then you take it to the client? How does that work?
Yeah, so we always want to get our hands on their product or service and try it out ourselves.
Okay.
So be testing it and seeing how that feels, gather the insights from that aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also ask for a brain dump. So we're going to look for anything in that brain dump that helps us put a foot forward in our testing. So what messages have worked in the past when you guys have tested through things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What are your customers saying about it in the reviews? Looking for patterns in there. And then just anything that we can get is kind of just geek out and really do a deep dive into the brand and the product itself. How is this differentiated in the market?
Yeah.
And get as familiar with it as we can so that we're not just kind of like shooting from the hip and we feel like we know how to position this thing in regards to its competitors or how to present it in a way that's really clear to the customer. And that's what you're really going for, is to find that place of clarity.
Definitely. Uh-huh. Was it a pretty interesting experience when Squatty Potty approached you? I feel like that wasn't really known thing.
So I wasn't honestly super excited about the get-go. I was intrigued for sure.
Yeah.
My brother was really excited about it. My brother Jeffrey was. And then I got my hands on one and started using it. And I was like, wait a minute, this is like genuinely a better experience. This feels like it's more natural the way we're supposed to actually poop. Because I mean, the Western way of pooping is very like sitting up. It's this, right? It's just like we are right now. It's just sitting upright. But if you go over into more of the Eastern countries, a lot of them just have a hole in the ground and they squat, and it's a much more natural position. And they have, Squatty Potty would have comments from their customers that would say, I was always wondering why I had the best poops ever when I was like out in the woods camping. When they're like squatting up against a tree or something, or like out in the middle of the brush. I'm like, wow. I'm like, I was all nervous to go to the bathroom out here in God's nature, but here I am and it's just coming so fast and everything. And they like, no one connects it scientifically, right? And they've recently even done a study on this where there was a medical journal that went and studied that and said that like it's genuinely a different, it's a healthier way to poop. And so that's ultimately what sold me on it, was that process of just getting one in my own bathroom and using it. And now we have one at Harmon Brothers in the bathrooms. We had them there, and someone stole all of them out of there. Like, there's like 3 or 4 bathrooms, because it's a community office space that we share with other people. And someone cleaned out all the Squatty Potties, and I remember a Slack message going up from one of our workers. Who's the jerk that stole all the Squatty Potties? And like, well, a lot of people get into this mentality of like, I don't like to poop from anywhere else but home, because, you know, now they got the portable Squatty Potties and stuff. So people will wait like to get home from the restaurant or whatever event they're at, aside from like the shame aspect of it, just to go home and like put their feet up and poop the proper way.
A different way to put your feet up.
Yeah.
Yep. No doubt. So we've got our client. We've got an idea established.
Yeah.
Let's move on to actually making it happen.
Yeah.
So what are the critical steps that go into, you know, actually shooting and creating the advertisement?
Yeah. Critical steps for us are casting.
Okay.
It's also one of the hardest steps to get right. In the book, Hey Whipple, Squeeze This, he explains 2 types of hell. There's regular and extra crispy. And he says extra crispy hell is when you're on a set like in the 14th hour, you know, you're going to 4 hours of overtime, and you've got an actor that can't nail their lines, and you're on your 50th take, and everyone's frustrated and done with it. It's like, you don't want to go through that. The point he makes in there is, like, you want to cast the better performer and not the better looker. And so that's a huge thing for us when we cast. Again, so much of what we do relies on brand characters, and they have to be super relatable.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Chatbooks.
Yeah.
The mom for Chatbooks was kind of at the top of our list. But initially, the brand had told us they wanted specifically someone quite a bit younger than that.
Interesting.
Yeah, they'd wanted a really young millennial mom. And we kind of cast a different person and put it because we thought was what the brand wanted. But really, our favorite was Lisa, this other woman that we ended up. She was our first audition.
Really?
First audition out of over 50.
Wow.
And I walked out of that audition, and I told one of our now creative directors at the time, he was producing with us, and I said, if we do no worse than her, we're just fine. Like, we can keep casting and do our background research, but she's amazing. And so we put our casting choice in front of the client, and honestly, they didn't like her at all. We were like, well, this is kind of what we thought you wanted. Yeah. And then we went and had a sit down with them and then showed them Lisa's audition, and they were like, that's her, that's the one. It wasn't what they described to us, but they were like, yeah, and we thought so too. But luckily, we all got aligned and everything with that, because generally, it hasn't been that way with our clients. When we cast someone, we put them forth, and they're just like, yeah, good, we trust you guys, just go with it, right?
Okay.
And we were really glad they pushed back, because we had only selected this other girl because Lisa, the one we really wanted, we thought felt like didn't match their description.
Interesting.
But again, when you're sitting with someone, in our videos, they're more long form.
Yeah.
And you're sitting with them for 2 minutes or up to 5 minutes, that kind of a thing. You really want to be able to connect with that character. It doesn't matter if it's a pretty face or whatever. I remember when Daniel Craig was cast for James Bond.
Yep.
You know, Pierce Brosnan had been the Bond before that.
Yep.
And everyone, the internet exploded. They're like, what? A blonde Bond? This is, you know, this is blasphemy and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they were just like, this guy doesn't fit the look or any of that kind of stuff. But he was a different kind of Bond, right?
Right.
Like, gone were the puns and all those things. He was like a grittiness to the character. And all of a sudden it worked. And that's the main thing, is people will buy into a performance if the look isn't slightly what you expected. And so casting's a huge one for us.
Okay.
You want to shoot for multiple formats, meaning generally we've got a camera that's shooting really high resolution, and you want to have your character positioned in a way that you can cut that and format it for a taller Facebook video and the wider YouTube, 16:9, and you can have that work for, you know, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever it is.
Right, right.
But you want to go through that process. I mean, generally we say the biggest cheat code of going through the production process is hire a really good producer, hire a great director. Usually the producer is going to help point you to a good director. Hire a great performer, a good actor. And then the rest usually kind of falls into place, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd say make sure you're shooting in a format that you can use for multiple mediums. And then I always say make sure your contingency budget, meaning your flex budget, is probably, especially if you're doing this for the first time, way bigger than you think. And that's something we've always done. We've always erred on the side of chewing into our own profit margins in order to make sure we get it right for the client, to help them fulfill their objective. Because, like, we can maybe go for short-term profitability, but that's not that's not really our game. We, like almost all of our videos, it seems like, have some sort of a little pickup shoot that we have to account for, or re-edits and getting feedback from fresh eyes, from people that haven't seen it before, people in the demographic, and then going back and re-editing again, little bits of rewrites. That it's kind of, if you read the book Creativity Inc., it's kind of that process, same process that Pixar goes through, where you don't know what you don't know until you're there.
Yeah.
Like, and all of a sudden when you're on set, it's like, oh, this joke isn't actually working, or this little bit of copy isn't working, and you just have to leave yourself that room, because if you all of a sudden don't budget enough time or enough money, then you just have to put out kind of a lackluster product and just hope for the best.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that. Yeah, you want to be able to budget to be human.
Yeah.
Budget to make mistakes, especially on your first time, that you are going to make mistakes, and allow yourself that opportunity. That, like, when you look at the great artists, like, I'm a really big fan of Norman Rockwell from way back, a really fantastic illustrator. And he had this exhibit that was on display at BYU, the college that Harmon Brothers is located close to. And what I was surprised to see is I just thought he was a brilliant genius, right? But then they had this part of the exhibit that showed his creative process of how many things he did to measure a person's face size and their body and how they fit structurally into things. And he tested different lighting sources in different positions and all these photographs and things that he did. And it was just so thorough that, like, he had this process where he had set himself up for success all the way along the way. It wasn't, oh, I'm just brilliant, I'm just going to do this. It was like, I know that if I follow these steps every time and draw and redraw and sketch and take photos and do all that stuff, then I will get there.
Right.
And that's kind of what you have to set yourself up for.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about budget.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of videos, especially the videos that you're creating, you know, I'm sure they have high budgets. It costs a lot of money to produce. How important would you say budget is? Like, do you have to have that high budget to be successful? Or, you know, can you get this stuff done with $1,000, $500?
The short answer is yes, you can get this stuff done for $1,000, for $500. You can shoot it on your phone.
Yep.
You can follow universal sales principles. As long as you're structuring your script in a way that's clear and relatable, then, yeah, you can do it on much, much less. The very first video that my brothers did was the Aura Brush video, and I just consulted a little bit on the side. I wasn't actually there shooting it, but it's $500 is what they shot it on. And we've probably never done a video for that amount since, but they were calling in favors with college students and all that kind of stuff to get it done. There's ways to do it scrappy. Like, anyone can actually learn to edit. Like, the tools are out there. Either if you have a Mac computer, you've got iMovie on there. I mean, YouTube has their own editor and stuff. There's ways to do it, and everyone has a filming device in their pocket now.
Exactly.
So there's not really excuses to not do it, as long as you're doing it in a way that more important is that script and that idea than having the super high-end budget. I'd say if you're gonna spend in one area where you've got limited budget, I'd say get some help on writing.
Okay.
If you're not a comedian, hire a comedian.
Yeah.
Bring in a comedian to help you write on stuff. I am a really good sales copywriter, and I can come up with jokes, but not nearly as often as some of our other writers can,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
They can spit out 5 jokes for every one I do, or more than that. And why not hire that efficiency rather than go through it yourself if you can, right? And so I'd say if you have very limited budget, scripting is a really good place to do it, and then leave yourself some leeway in the editing to edit to where it's made. Ron Howard, the director, he says the edit is where the film is really made, and we believe it's the same way with...
Yeah, that was actually my next question, is how important in this process is the editing? I mean, does editing make or break these advertisements, or can you get away with kind of not as knowledgeable of an editor?
Yeah, so for us, the edit is a make or break. You've got to get the script right, you've got to film it and all those types of things, but so much of it is made or broken in the edit. And what I mean by that is you can get in there. This is our standard edit, right? We get in there, an editor's gone off, taken the footage from the set, he's gone off and edited it, put it together what we call an assembly cut or a rough cut, comes back, shows it to a creative director, and usually the first thing is the creative director watches it and is like, we just wasted so much money. And that's generally like our first impression of it. It's like, oh my gosh, like what have we done? We've got enough reps now that we don't truly think that, but you always think to yourself, we've got our work cut out for us in a big way. Every single one of our videos is really crappy to begin with. Just garbage. Like if we were to put the first edit out in front of you guys, you'd just be like, these guys aren't experts.
Yeah.
What are they? They're a bunch of, you know, bunch of posers. Yeah. Literally so much of it is that endurance in editing. When you get into that editing process of then cutting out things that you don't need and focusing on the right stuff, one of the big things is you start to get tunnel vision. And so in the same thing with writing, you can be writing a really great script, but you eventually want to take it to other people and go through the brutal, embarrassing process of having someone shoot this down and be like, did you identify this problem? Did you see this? That's not working for me there. It's got to be the same thing with editing, where they go through and they're like, I don't like that joke. That's not working for me. That's not selling me. And then like those fresh eyes can inform so much.
Yeah.
And then with editing, we'll also find that something we didn't think about in filming, you can fix with either adding in a sound effect, or you can bring in some sort of graphics that will help that out. You can save yourself in a lot of ways there.
Yeah.
And there's some really fun things you can do in the edit that might not be the way that you had originally imagined it at all.
Exactly.
But you want to make it work, right? Because back onto set is very expensive. And when it's more like you working with your editor, it's just a smaller team, not burning as many hours as quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, you want to budget that time to go through that editing process to show up people and to see what actually is working. I'll tell you, you set yourself up the biggest for success when you're too afraid to show other people and get yourself embarrassed. The people that don't fear failure and don't fear embarrassment, scripting, in editing, in any of those things, those are the people that make huge strides in being able to put that stuff out there
right. And
get the feedback they need to make it better.
Exactly. So failure.
Failure's great.
You've got a lot of successes, but there's got to be some that just fell flat.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk us through a couple examples or an example that, you know, wasn't as shiny as some of the things that we've seen, and kind of what did you learn from that, or how do those failures make yourself a better creative and a better salesman?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a success and a little bit of a failure. I'll point out to one with our client Zero Res, which does carpet cleaning, and that's a service, it's not a product, right? We made a video that initially, the concept was focused on a soap opera. Okay. And it was like, it was a little bit of a bait and switch, meaning it started out making you think it's one way, and then it turns and it's talking about soap opera. But then we made another video for them because it wasn't getting the numbers that we were happy with or that they were ultimately happy with, that focused much more on a straightforward test of grinding, putting into carpet.
Right.
And seeing how that happened over time. And then if you clean it with Zero Res versus you clean it with another carpet cleaner, and then how that stain came back. And we did a time lapse on it and everything. And that was much more straightforward. The sale was much more clear. Both videos were very proud of. But at the end of the day, starting off subject as opposed to on was a little bit more costly to us. That if you go for kind of a bait and switch type of thing, like if you think of purple, she starts right on subject, right?
Right.
She says, you know, how can you tell if your bed's awful? And then she does the ache test and all that.
Yep.
So interesting thing. Purple, we did not have it scripted with the ache test at the beginning.
Really?
It was coming in like a minute later into the video. And we just kept thinking, what is wrong with this? And then it was like, oh, we're burying our lead.
Yeah.
We hadn't written it that way.
I mean, that's the
but
catch.
Then we hadn't filmed it that way or anything. We ended up cutting it and putting it right up at the beginning. And everyone thinks, oh, the way they did it, ah, this is genius and stuff. No. Well, I guess we got to that place. But as writers, like we hadn't thought through it that way.
Yeah.
And so we cut it so that was, at the beginning, that was our lead. And so much of those first few seconds matter so much because when you're scrolling through Facebook, you got that autoplay going and it has to grab them immediately. And so with Zero Res, we learned to grab people better. We needed to start more on subject and it just converted way better. So that was one. Now, both videos were successful in their own right. And we still use both of them in the campaign in a portfolio approach. But the lead video now is that one where it shows that pudding test of it being grounded into the carpet and stuff.
Right. Yeah. So no pressure to answer this.
Okay.
Were any eggs broken on the set of Purple Mattress?
Were any eggs broken?
Yes.
So yes.
Okay.
And let me clarify that. We had an egg break after it had been dropped over and over and over and over again. And when the glass shifted over onto the thing. Yes. So towards the end of the day when we were filming, it had been doing just fine. But enough of those times, and then like when it had shifted onto the purple, like there had been a sideways pressure on it.
Yeah.
Finally, one of them like did crack and break. But that one you see at the very end of the video when it falls down and it comes up and it's just nonstop shot where she goes in and bursts those eggs. That's all real. Like like I said, nothing sells better than the truth. And obviously they broke every time on those competitors' mattresses and stuff. But it was a real thing. It took a lot of testing to find out what was that perfect test that gave us the consistency for filming.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the real deal.
Very cool.
Okay.
So last question of the day. And, you know, we all have different businesses. Some of us have, you know, e-commerce businesses. We have physical products. Some of us have digital products. Some of us are, you know, service-based businesses.
Yeah.
Does this approach work for all of these types of businesses? And how do you kind of go about, you know, finding that flow with all of these different types of businesses?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So we don't think of it in terms of we sell products. We think of it in terms or that we sell services. We sell solutions. And so if you have a product or a service that solves a fundamental solution for the customer, then you have a really great place to operate from.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way we think of it. So for example, like I said, Zero Res is very, very successful, and that's a carpet cleaning service.
Yeah.
It's not a product like Squatty Potty or like Purple or like FiberFix or any of these. And then also ClickFunnels was one of our clients' very successful campaign, the same kind of thing, where that's a service. So if you think of it in terms more of the problem to be solved the way to relate with your customer and how you differentiate yourself in the marketplace, you're in a much better space than like, oh, does this work for a product or a service? I think that's a much better starting point.
Makes a lot of sense. I'm ready to go write some ads.
Cool.
All right, everyone. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Digital Marketer Podcast. If you like the show, hit that subscribe button. And for more information, go to digitalmarketer.com/podcast. Thank you for listening.
Hey DM listeners, if you're running a Black Friday or Cyber Monday special, listen up. Because Digital Marketer just released our Canva Holiday Promo Pack. It includes almost 200 templates that you can use to make the graphics for all your upcoming holiday specials and three unique design themes for each holiday. The Promo Pack is usually $27, but you can get it today for free. Check the show notes for the link to download, or you can go directly to digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates. That's digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates.